roll cameras, action, sausages.
Okay.
I need to Google my thing. You're doing the introduction while I Google.
I'm Christian Perfect. Currently Googling is David Cushing.
Hello.
We're sat in the library of Newcastle University's School of Maths and Stats, surrounded by mathematical knowledge.
It smells very nice.
David, does it occur to you that even in this room with all these books here, there's like 0.5% of the mathematical knowledge that is accessible through that iPad? There's more maths in your iPad than in this entire room.
Not if I turn it off Wi-Fi.
Symbolism's great, but the actual facts of it.
What if the Wi-Fi goes up?
Yeah, well, that, then you're in trouble.
I've Googled what I wanted to Google.
Okay.
You
might as well tell me what it is then.
Well, there's quite a cool guy called Terry Tam.
Is there?
So,
what? You mean like in addition to the Fields Medal winning mathematician?
Yeah, he's so cool. Not many people have really mentioned his cool new paper he's put in the archive.
I know, I haven't been hearing much buzz on the streets.
I was going to tell you to put in the periodical, but I forgot. So I was going to tell you I did the kind of math to do it, but I forgot. And I nearly forgot to do it, but I remembered at the last minute.
That's cool. Is this the thing that you...
It's his survey on the polynomial method in arithmetic combinatorics. It's very good.
That's my excited face. Tell me what it's about.
It's about the polynomial method.
Which is?
So there's lots of hard problems in additive combinatorics.
Yeah.
Which is, it's a sort of type of number theory, but it happens in rings and stuff. It's about the arithmetic structure things have, but it's quite hard.
Okay.
So what people do is they'll, instead of analysing a certain set, they will find a suitable polynomial whose zeros contain that set.
Okay.
Then you just use algebraic geometry to analyse the polynomial, and it tells you information about the set.
Okay.
And you can come up with lots of nice things in combinatorics. It just pops out.
Is the use of generating functions for things a trivial example of that, or is it something else?
I don't know.
You know where you like... lots of counting arguments, you use generating functions for stuff.
Yeah.
And I can never do it. Like, I never think of that as a proof method. And then someone comes up with a really simple proof for accounting. Oh. Okay, so...
Yeah, it has lots of nice things like that. And it's actually accessible. Well, I know I'm a PhD student, so I should be good at maths.
Yeah.
But I don't come from this area,
mm-hmm.
and I'm reading through it perfectly fine.
Okay.
By reading through, I've gone through 14 pages of 43.
It's pretty good going.
And I haven't got stuck yet.
Good. Is there anything particularly interesting you've learned?
There's
apart from that you don't know how to use your iPad stand.
There's a very cool generalisation of one of my favourite theorems, which we mentioned last time. The ham sandwich theorem. Sorry.
Google. I almost had a ham sandwich for lunch today.
My iPad's broke trying to search for the word sandwich. Oh, I can't spell it. No, it's not in. How do you spell sandwich? Is that how you spell sandwich?
No, it's just a W, not WH.
Okay. Bear with
it's us. Not like Which Sand, the consumer magazine for sand buyers.
There we go. The polynomial ham sandwich, Stephen. So we mentioned last time you take it's just Google sandwich now. I shouldn't use technology. Instead of
it's not on fire yet, you're fine.
So last time we talked about the ham sandwiches, you had some objects in R cubed, so
yeah.
Three-dimensional space.
Yeah.
And no matter how you made your sandwich up with cheese and stuff, you could bisect it with a plane and cut it in half each. So the actual hand sandwich thing, a bit like the bisection theme we were talking about, was you take bodies in R to the N, convex shape in R to the N, you can have so many depending on how many dimensions you're in, and you can always find a plane, or really it's going to be RTDM-1 shape, but I can cut it in half.
Do you call those hyperplanes?
Yes, I think.
Okay.
Maybe, I don't know. I don't care either. Anyway.
Right.
It turns out you can take quite a few more shapes and cut them in half. If instead of using planes, so instead of using generalising the line, you use polynomials.
Whoa.
So normally in dimension n you can have n shapes you can cut up, but if you have a polynomial of degree d, then you can cut up d plus n choose n shapes. So the just setting your polynomial to degree 3, you can see you can do quite a lot of serious shit. I just think that's quite nice. They've got a few other things like that. And
well, that makes sense though, doesn't it? You make a one wibbly shape, the more stuff you can cut in half.
The whole paper seems to be on things like counting arguments in sets. Sets have a certain size. That's how they prove that thing. And then right at the end, he decides to throw a bit of number theory in. Because he can. Because he's Terry Tao, I think. Things like,
well, he's like, stand aside, I'm Terry Tao.
That comes in.
Special case of Baker's theorem. This is theorem 7.2. There exists he can't even get his plurals to agree. There exist absolute constants c, both greater than zero, such that mod of 3 to the p minus 2 to the q is greater than or equal to is little c over q to the big c times 3 to the p for all natural numbers pq. So the difference between a power of 3 and a power of 2 is greater than or equal to something. There are always big gaps between. No, you want. You'd think you'd want there to be small gaps between powers of 3 and powers of 2.
No, but it happens that there's big gaps. No, but.
Oh, but for all choices.
Yeah.
Oh.
Which is rather cool. And then he has another things, which, again, this is when I get lost when they say things have certain orders, and, you know, who cares about orders? Is my iPad just in front of the mic?
Yeah. I'd also just move the mic. I don't know.
Yeah, it's quite interesting to read because it starts proving like very easy things. So it proves that a polynomial of degree d has at most d roots, which is most things first year undergrads would do. And then a few pages later, it uses it by saying if you take any field and any two points in the field squared, so that's like r squared, then they must lie on a line. Now I know that's quite an obvious thing in r squared, but he proves it for any field. Then he goes further, any 5 points in f squared lie on a conic section, any 9 points lie on a cubic curve. So if you give me any 9 points in R squared, I can find a cubic that goes through them all. Which is quite nice. You don't look impressed.
I've come to expect these things from polynomials.
Anyway, that's his paper. And I was going to talk about... I was shocked at how good he is at writing surveys and stuff. I knew he was a clever man.
That's sort of his deal though, isn't it? He does that a lot on the blog.
Yeah. Well, I never really read his blog because whenever I went on, he was just talking about his research, and therefore it's inaccessible.
Okay.
But I've since went to the library and got his book out on additive combinatorics, which is amazing. And I was going to talk about the probabilistic method, but I left it at home. And the probabilistic method's quite cool.
It's one of my favourite methods.
Do you want to explain it then?
You proved that. By doing something at random, certain things happen with probability zero, and hence
it exists. Very, very non-constructive.
Yeah.
And constructivists would probably be going mental.
But it's not experimental maths, where you check the first million cases and say it doesn't happen. So it's way better than that, philosophically.
Yeah.
That's not even non-constructive. That's didn't try if
He's tried a bit.
Tried a little bit, Dave. Okay. Right, well, talking of survey articles, I've done a little survey myself. I've looked through my interesting esoterica collection for things on the subject of food, because I can't remember what we said something yesterday. Was it you mentioning the Swiss cheese thing?
Yeah, I got it wrong. I thought it was called, there's a paper, I thought it was called The Classification of Swiss Cheeses.
Yeah.
And I looked it up and it was a word that sounded like classification, which I've now forgotten.
Compactification?
No.
That sounds like something you do. Anyway, I found another one called Swiss Cheeses, Rational Approximation and Universal Plane Curves by Joel Feinstein.
Feinstein, he works in...
It's
Nottingham.
Nottingham, yeah. He's
I've seen him talk a couple of times. Once on the something of Swiss cheeses, which I forgot.
The something of Swiss
cheeses. There's other spaces, though. There's not just Swiss cheese spaces. There's something called the Roadrunner space.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Yeah, and there's a book, somebody called Alice created all these Swiss cheeses.
Surname Alice or first name Alice?
I don't know.
Just Alice.
But they wrote a survey about all of Alice's work on Alice in Switzerland. Which, if you check, it might even be referenced in this paper.
Oh, right, okay.
Where have you gone?
Yeah, here we go. Let's get to the bottom. Alice in Switzerland. Well, I'm going to have to search, aren't I?
Cheaper, that's a good paper.
A Cheaper Swiss Cheese by T.W. Kerner in Studia Mathematica. I'm going to have to look that one up as well.
Ooh, who wrote number 13?
If we end up using the sneaky backup audio, I'm recording with the laptop. I can only apologise for the typing noises that are happening. A Cheaper Swiss Cheese. It's available from eudml.org, which I think might be an open access. The European Digital Mathematics Library. This one's going in the collection. Oh, it's funnily typeset. It's all been scanned in.
I'll scan you in.
What, you're going to look me up and down? What does that mean?
I don't know. I'm making noises while I'm doing it.
Introduction. McKissick has constructed an elegant Swiss cheese K with the following property. Can you stop making noises on the table, please?
Fine.
Oh. Right. Yeah, that's a pretty cool paper. Anyway, I was talking about food.
Well, obviously, you wrote paper 30.
Oh,
slow down
30.
A bit.
13. Someone.
Never
oh, Feinstein.
Ah, right.
Bounded derivations from Banach algebras, his PhD thesis.
Ah, right.
Unless it was the other author, because Feinstein looks a bit. I don't think he did his PhD in 2008.
No, maybe it's the guy above.
Yeah, maybe it's the other guy.
Oh, there was a Darth Dale's paper there.
Where?
Under D.
Who was that first one? Mario Bonk.
That's a good name.
Quasi-conformal geometry of fractals. This paper is a delight.
That's the big point conjecture.
This is a good bibliography. I think we're going to give this an 8 out of 10. It might. It's Virgil.
5 out of 5.
Oh, right, because Feinstein is cited as a separate person, so
yeah.
The --- must be the other guy.
Is there any more good
M.
to
Heath. Right, what did you say there was? Dawson. Dales.
So I just know him, so I just wonder what paper it was.
Uniform algebra. Not too many Swiss cheese. Ooh! Approximations Eigenschaften and Strahlengrenzwerte Merorf.
I am not attempting to say
that. Strahlengrenzwerte Merorfe and Ganzer Funktionen. Oh, that was hard. A. Roth, Learn English.
Oh, topological characterization of the Sierpinski curve.
Where are we here? Oh, Wyvern.
This is a very good bibliography.
Oh, that's very good. Then, finally, at the end, something in Chinese. Jewish. Theory of an entire and meromorphic functions. What does meromorphic mean? That's why I was having trouble. I've never read that word before. Deficient and asymptotic values in singular. Okay, right, anyway, food. food, David.
Right.
You mentioned Swiss cheese, and I said
ham sandwich theorem.
No, I didn't say ham sandwich theorem. But that's a good link. I said carrots for dinner. It turns out the paper I have saved is carrots for dessert, the sequel paper. Is that pleased you? Oh no, I've got it wrong even. Carrots for dessert was a section of a paper someone wrote. The paper itself was called On Polynomial-Like Mappings. But then these guys have, I don't know, extended it. And you'd be pleased to learn we have asymptotic shrinking of dyadic carrot fields.
This
it sounds like something an agriculture minister would have to respond to.
Maybe.
Oh, copies of the Mandelbrot set. Somehow carrots have something to do with it. We have a parabolic Mandelbrot set. Dyadic carrot. So I think carrots are just, they're named that because they have, they're shaped like a carrot and it's like fat at the top, down to a point. I think. They remark that such carrots are small when the dyadic denominator is large, but they do not even try to prove a precise such statement. In this paper, we formulate and prove a precise statement of asymptotic shrinking of dyadic carrot fields around M. Carrots. Okay. So, turns out I've got a few foodie things saved here. We've done Swiss cheese and carrots. I have, of course, the seminal paper proving that if you peel an orange,
you
starting at the
top
and spiralling round to the other pole, aka the root, then you flatten out that peel, you have a Euler curve or Fresnel integral.
Which proved it's equal to some sort of pi thing.
Yeah, there's some sort of pi thing in there. An Euler curve is one where the radius of curvature is linear in t. I have someone's, I'm not sure what it was, a PhD thesis or a master's or something. It's on the archive anyway, cake cutting mechanisms. Someone's written a survey of the history of cake cutting algorithms. So like the simple, if there's two of us, we had a cake between us, I'm going to cut it in half and you get to pick which half you want. That's fair.
Have you seen Ian Stewart write up on this?
I have not.
Yeah, it's quite a nice one. He tries to say one about three people cutting the cake. It's very confusing. He convinces you it's fair and then he tells you why it isn't fair.
Okay, this person is doing, did a BSc in computer science and philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
That's a weird join up.
I don't like philosophy.
Igor Yanovsky in Auckland. Lots of Kiwis in that shield there. It's three Kiwis. It's three more Kiwis than we've got in ours. We mustn't allow a Kiwi gap.
Yeah, but
develop.
We have more lions, don't we?
Oh, we have lions. A Kiwi doesn't
do we have
fear
two
a lion.
Lions?
Kiwis don't fear anything, though, that's the thing.
Why?
They don't have no fear of outside predators.
Yeah, but we can have a Kiwi in our office, they can't have a lion in theirs.
What are you saying?
We have a Kiwi in the office.
We have a little noddy Kiwi, yeah.
Yeah, they can't have a lion in their office, can
they? Well, they could have a toy lion, like we have a toy Kiwi.
Do you think it would have the same hat problem?
I don't think it would have the same hat problem. Well, I don't know. Yeah, I suppose the mane of a lion is a good place for a hat to secure
itself.
I'd
give it a party hat.
A party hat for a lion. Oh, I'd love it if a lion was like about to roar and instead it went to the party pooper. That would be incredible. Anyway. This is someone's dissertation, it turns out, on cake cutting, and there's a lot of game theory about the different protocols for splitting up cake between various numbers of people in various situations. That's cool. We have computer analysis of sprouts with Nimbers.
Nimbers?
Nimbers.
What's a Nimber?
A Nimber is...
Is it a number associated with the game Nim?
Yes. Because you know that games can be numbers. John Conway's deal.
Oh, it's weird thing.
Yeah. I think it's that, or it might just be like the number of moves for a game of Nim with N bits or something.
I think I'll save Conway for next time to say that he's a cool guy.
Yeah, Conway's been popping up in a few places recently.
Yeah, the thing with how many parts of the body do you have beginning with three letters?
Yeah, Conway reckons between 10 and 15. That's the kind of thing you could safely take to your grave and, like, have just made up the number. And people for hundreds of years ago, what did Conway know? What secret knowledge did he have access to? The Nimba, something. Anyway, Sprouts is a game, Nim is a game. You can match the two up.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go. For more, read Conway on Numbers and Games. I've got a copy of that somewhere. Is it at home? Yes. It's not. It's not in my office, is it? Oh, it is. It is in my office. I should have brought it down.
Why didn't you?
Because I'm a chump. Okay, on the same vein as the cake cutting thing, we have how to eat 4/9 of a pizza. It's basically the same.
Oh, this is a bit like something. Ah, oh, what's it a bit like? Oh, that card trick.
What card trick?
The card trick.
What's that?
Where you add up and do forces. The 10 in a row, you only pick left or right.
Okay.
So somebody takes a piece and then you can only pick.
Yeah, okay.
So somebody takes a piece and then you can only pick left or right. The proof's a bit like that.
Yeah, right.
But it's very weird because it can have empty slices. So before the game begins, you see between these two slices there's 7 empty slices.
Whoa.
Which I don't like.
I don't want an empty slice of pizza.
Yeah, I could get.
I mean,
really
I limit myself typically to, like, 4 slices. So if some of those are empty. Right. The abstract of this says, given two players alternately picking pieces of a pizza sliced by radial cuts in such a way that after the first piece is taken, every subsequent chosen piece is adjacent to some previously taken piece, we provide a strategy for the starting player to get 4/9 of the pizza. This is best possible and settles the conjecture of Peter Winkler.
That's a good name.
Take that, Winkler. You've winkled at your last. So did you already know about this paper or this result or
4/9 of pizza?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did I show it to you a while ago?
Well, I remember reading it. Though.
Okay. Right. Finally, I have a couple of papers that Tanya Kovanova put on the archive recently on the Cookie Monster problem.
Never heard of it.
Now, David, you've often claimed to be Batman, but the voice you say it in leads me to believe you might be the Cookie Monster. Yeah, that. The Cookie Monster problem supposes that the Cookie Monster wants to empty a set of jars filled with various numbers of cookies. On each of his moves, he may choose any subset of jars and take the same number of cookies from each of those jars. So it's like Crazy Nim. The Cookie Monster number of a set is the minimum number of moves the Cookie Monster must use to empty all of the jars. We discuss bounds of the Cookie Monster number and explicitly find the Cookie Monster number of the jars containing cookies in the Fibonacci, Tribonacci, Ennacci, and Super Ennacci sequences. Super Ennacci, David. You've lost interest, haven't you?
No.
You're reading a different book. Right, what's that book?
I don't know. I've tried to find something interesting from the forest, but I haven't found anything yet.
That's incredible. What book is it?
100 Essential Things You Didn't Know You Didn't Know.
So, some books, on the cover it says, you can open it at any page and find something to delight. This empirically does not apply to this book. So do you say don't buy it?
It hasn't. No, I really enjoyed it. It's just, you know, I've read
it's
it
just
now.
Outside context, rubbish.
How to settle a divorce fairly. I met the man who wrote this.
How do you describe him?
He just tried to make me buy another one of his books.
A huckster.
He did sign it though.
Yeah, that was very good of him.
So,
We're talking about John Barrow, by the way.
Yes, we are. I've liked one of his books and couldn't read the second one. The President Who Preferred the Triangle to the Pentagon. Apparently James Garfield, the 20th President of the United States, came up with a proof of Pythagoras' theorem.
That's true.
I hope all of you saw that at all.
Well, that's all well and good, but Napoleon came up with an entire triangle centre, so I think he wins in head of state maths.
Do you know what space the space of barcodes makes up?
I told you this yesterday. Stop telling me my own fact.
It's an interesting fact, though, isn't it?
Yeah, barcodes lie on a Klein bottle inside the space of all possible however many digit strings.
Which is pretty cool.
That is described in the paper Barcodes, the Persistent Topology of Data.
Easy question.
Yep.
Why were VHS tapes made with Mobius strips so that you didn't have to rewind them?
Because they get caught as it is. It would just be really mechanically weird.
Would have been cool.
Yeah, but it would have been difficult.
I'm sure there's some good things in here.
Well, maybe if like DVDs hadn't come along, the next version of VHS would have been Mobius strips.
I wish I had one of them. Leonard Green had one of them, which would have blew your mind.
You're showing me the thing where you cut up a square into bits and rearrange it into something with a bigger area.
Yeah. Leonard Green did that in a fixed thing 5 times, and there was clearly no room for it. Oh, that's quite an interesting one. Playing, you've got a bias coin. How do you make a decision with it fairly?
Okay. You flip it twice and you only look for heads, tails, or tails, heads.
Yep. Right, well, we've got 98 chaos theory, 99, I don't know, yeah.
Right, out of 100 things that are supposedly fascinating and...
We've got
that?
A couple.
Yeah, there's a few. Okay.
I do have 2 more things to mention from my piece of paper.
Oh, excellent.
The arithmetic derivative.
Oh, did we not talk about that last time? Okay, cool. Let's do that.
So, here's a way to differentiate the natural numbers.
They all go to 0.
No.
Well, that's one way.
That's a stupid way. He's a non-zero. So what we want to do is come up on a map from the natural numbers to the natural numbers.
David.
What?
0 is a fixed point of that.
What?
0 is a fixed point of the normal derivative. It's pretty cool. It's like there's only e to the x and 0. Just blew your mind. Carry on.
Anyway, what we want is a function from the natural number to the natural numbers that satisfies the product rule. So that is, we want f of ab to be equal to af of b plus f of a, b.
Good pausing. We all understood exactly the syntax of that.
So one method, well actually, the way you actually do it is you say the derivative of a prime is 1.
Okay.
And then you use unique prime factorization. So what's the derivative of 7, Christian?
1.
What's the derivative of 10?
2 times 1 plus 5 times 1, which is 7.
Correct.
The second derivative of 10 is 1.
Exactly.
I use both facts. Do you see
what's
how I...
What's the derivative of 27?
What's that? 3 times 3 times 3?
Yes.
3 times the derivative of 9 plus 9 times 1.
Yes. And the derivative of 9 is...
3 times the derivative is 6.
Yes.
So it's 90. No, it's 18 plus 9 is 27.
Yes.
Whoa! That's a fact I didn't know a week ago. Well, I knew it a week ago, but I didn't know it in the interval between then and now.
So there's quite a cool fact you can do with powers. So a to the b differentiated is equal to b dashed a to the b minus 1.
So like the normal rule.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
And using that rule, you can extend differentiation to the rational numbers. But you can't extend it to all the irrational numbers. Well, you probably can, but I just don't think people have done it. Because you can do it for root 2, because you just say the square root of 2 is 2 to the half. Differentiate that, the half comes down, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, okay.
But doing it for any other ones, people can't do. So you might want to say that's why pi is the limit of something, but you can write it as the limit in two different ways. The limits might not converge, and so unfortunately people don't know what how to differentiate pi, which is sad.
Could we invent a derivative where like the derivative of pi is 1 and then everything else goes on trig functions or something crazy?
Well, it'd be nice if you could, if the derivative worked for continued fractions, the limit of continued fractions. It'd be lovely if that worked, but it probably won't. People would have checked it. Because I think that's the universal way to limit something, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's independent of base. It's quite nice.
I do like continued fractions. We'll never be forgiven for using the decimal expansion of continuous constant instead of the continued fraction.
YouTube is still going mental.
Oh man, the comments wars are raging.
All the people who say we forgot the CNC sequence or the Fibonacci sequence as well. Simon Singh's favourite sequence is the Fibonacci sequence.
Well, his favourite one that he can announce to a pub of non-mathematicians.
I was there. I was a mathematician.
He didn't know that you were there. You're patting your pi tattoo.
In mathematical power. He's a cool thing I learned from that book that I said wasn't very good.
Right.
A different way of doing tallies. So when you're counting things, you go 1, 2.
Wait a minute.
Three,
what
four,
have you written down on this bit of paper?
VHS Mobius.
Why?
Because I didn't forget it while you were having a rant or
something. Oh, okay.
About cakes.
Okay, you're right. What have you done?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4,
you're doing tally marks.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a different one.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9,
10. You've done like the four corners of a square and then the boundary of it and then the diagonals.
Yeah.
Well, you could do it with like any picture. Well, let me do one. 1, 2, 3... 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Oh, but the hairs making it difficult.
What, there are exactly 6 hairs?
Yeah, but you can't just see that at a glimpse.
14, 15, 16, 17, 18.
Yeah, but at a glimpse you need to know whether or not it's proper. You need something like that. Well, I think that's more glimpsable than a tally.
I don't know, like, up to, what did we get to? I had 2 eyes, and I had a nose, and then a mouth, so up to 4 it's okay. 6 I can do because I did ears next.
Well, maybe you just counted 7s then, add the 5th, add the round bit.
I'll make the hair one thing, 7, 8, 9, 10. You've done the Chinese symbol for man?
As his
on the
body.
Bottom there, as his body, because it's an ideograph or a pictograph or something. I can't remember which one it is.
Anyway, back to differentiation. Take a prime.
Oh man, why do I think of 57? I hate that stupid story.
Let's just say 7.
Can I say 59? Or does it need to be a small one?
59 I'll do.
Okay.
Now what we do is we look at the triple derivative of its square.
Oh man, I want a small one.
So the derivative of 59
is 1.
Is of 59 squared, sorry, is 59 of 59, which is 108.
You've written 109 somehow, despite saying 108 and the answer being 108.
So then we get the double derivative of 108. What's the first derivative? It's 2 times 59.
Yeah.
So it's 2 times 1 plus 1 times 59, so it's a derivative of 61.
Yeah.
Which is 1.
61's a prime, right.
Yeah. So sometimes a prime squared differentiated 3 times gives you 1. What if we look at 7 squared differentiated 3 times? It goes to 14 derivative twice.
Yeah.
It goes to 9 derivative, which goes to 6, so it doesn't give 1.
Oh, what?
It turns out it gives 1 if and only if p plus 2 is a prime.
Oh, yeah, this is the thing you told me a while ago.
Yeah, so there are an infinite number of primes such that the triple derivative of p squared is 1 if and only if the twin prime conjecture is true.
That's pretty cool. Do you think you might be able to prove the fact about arithmetic derivatives before someone proves the fact about the about primes?
I don't know, they're getting pretty close, aren't they?
Yeah.
They've now got like 600 now.
Yeah.
To be fair, they haven't made that much progress.
Yeah.
Like, in the past year, so in 2,000 years, or however long since people started thinking about the problem, they went from infinity to 7 billion.
700 million.
700 million. And then all they've done is went from 700 million to 600 in a year. That's not as impressive.
He's
another one. So instead of thinking of this, you can think of, does the triple integral of 1 contain infinitely many prime squares?
Is that the same question or not?
Yes, it is.
Right.
But I like integrals better.
But integrals aren't unique here. Oh, they're never unique, I suppose.
Right.
What do you call like the constant of... You don't have like a constant
no,
of integration.
We don't.
Do you have
integrals in this case just gives a set. It gives all the numbers that can be differentiated.
Okay.
So basically, is the triple integral of 1, does it contain infinitely many p squareds? And here's another one. Does every even number have an integral?
Do most?
Most do. Most have checked for do. And the reason is let's say we take an even number, 2k, equal to p plus q.
Yeah.
Then the derivative of pq is equal to p plus q. So if Goldbach's conjecture is true. Goldbach's conjecture is true.
Very good.
Then every even number has an integral. So you can somehow fudge your way. And like someone made a comment, I've been trying to reconstruct the book on quite, that you can get Fermat's as theorem in terms of arithmetic derivatives. And there's lots of other things apparently.
Yep. Did you not get the Fermat's last theorem one?
No, I thought I did, but it didn't look right.
Oh, okay.
I just played about for a bit. And I haven't got anything on here for Goldbach. Like, the way I've stated the triple primes one isn't the one I found on the internet. I played about with it a bit to make it a if and only if. And that, I think that's it on arithmetic differentiation. You're good.
I only prepared one thing. Hand me the big old book.
I drop it on the table so people at home know.
Yeah, hang on, let me look at the sound wave while it happens.
It's quite heavy.
Yeah. Yeah, that has just blasted the microphone.
What's it on?
I have in front of me a book on a couple of things.
Boobs.
It's not a book on boobs.
Okay.
Now, actually, I was trying to find the book on boobs for you because a while ago, were you here when we had this? There's
no.
A French mathematician whose name I've forgotten, but he self-published his monographs about something mathematical.
Yes, I've heard.
Are you aware
about
here?
This.
And just throughout the book, he's inserted colour plates of naked women, just to, I don't know, to motivate the reader, to reward you for getting that far, or just because he's a massive pervert. I don't know. And there's a very cool picture of him on the very last page. What's there?
What's he doing?
What's he doing? He's just sort of. It's from the 70s. Like, you know how men posed in the 70s for photos? He's doing that. I think he might have a button or two undone on his shirt. I'm not sure. He's French. I don't know if that's just the way it's done. Okay, so the book I have, it has my name in the front, so basically I wrote it.
Most of my books don't have my name in the front. They have someone else's name.
Well, this one's big enough that I thought I'd better stick my name in it. It's The Princeton Companion to Mathematics. Timothy Gowers was the editor. I noticed the front says June Barrow Green and Imre Leader are the associate editors.
Tim Gowers is quite a clever man as well.
Tim Gowers is worth two women, it seems.
Doesn't he have a knighthood?
He does now. He didn't when this was published. Well, have I got to call him Sir Tim now?
Does that out-trump a CBE then?
I think so.
Cause
wait, no. Isn't a CBE a knighthood? Because they're... There's an MBE and OBE, the lower ones, and a CBE is a knighthood.
All right. Oh, that means I saw a knight the other day.
A companion of the order.
No,
of the
no, it isn't. What are the what do you call a woman of a CBE? A dame.
Yeah.
I saw that person who gave a seminar must have been a dame then.
Yeah, she probably was.
because Sarah introduced her as the only pure mathematician with a CBE.
That's really not true. Maybe it's, maybe CBE's higher up. There are different kinds of knight. Alright, we'll find this out for next time, or you can do it on your iPad while I'm looking for things. So the Princeton Companion to Maths, what does it want to be? It's a one-of-a-kind reference for anyone with a serious interest in mathematics. Not
is
for me, though.
Is there a Matty called Gowers? Because that's when Gowers Wong got to some dodgy things. I'm just going to close that.
Right.
Go on.
Yeah, this book doesn't contain a huge amount on geometric group theory.
Does it contain all of maths?
No, it doesn't. I'm just telling you what it doesn't contain. Yeah, I bought this when I started my PhD thing, and this would be a good reference for all the bits and bobs that I'll need to read. And it has almost nothing. So I don't know really what it's for.
I got really angry when I saw Book and Water Stones. I said, the book of... It wasn't called this, it was something like, the book of everything interesting about mathematics.
Was it like a sarcastically small book?
No, it was a popular science book.
What?
Released at Christmas for non-mathematicians about how, like, infinity's big and the golden ratio appears in pineapples.
That's fibs. It's fibs, David. Jeez Louise. Right, what did I just say? I just saw a thing about the monster group. This podcast could be called Reading a Book. While the microphone listens. Modular forms.
Ooh, modular.
The monster group. Right, I was expecting a pretty good bit about the longest, biggest, hardest theorem in all of maths. Oh, there is a separate section on that, so maybe there is. But no, it's like a half a column. There are two columns in a page, and it's half a column about the monster group. Two lines of which occupied giving the order of the group. Where do you reckon V.7 might be? I mean, I at the moment. Oh god, where am I? I'm in IV. I'm still in IV. Still in IV. IV. Wow, whoever wrote about the classification of finite simple groups did not know much about it. Although the central limit theorem gets a paragraph. Ugh. So this book, I'm going to give it a C minus out of 10. That's all I got. You got anything else?
I've got some proofs I want to talk about.
Okay, talk about some proofs.
So this is an existence proof. So
there's nothing on that bit of paper. Nothing exists. You haven't.
I'm gonna prove it. There's some bounds on the prime counting function. So pi of x, we say, is the number of primes less than equal to x.
Yeah.
You can show that there are at least, I think it's 7 primes less than or equal to 23, using these bounds. Right. Now, obviously, you could count those primes, but let's just use this.
Right.
This is at least 7. Then, we look at, which ones are going to be...
15, 17,
17,
19, 8.
8, but there's at least 7.
Okay.
We're not actually analysing the numbers. We're not analysing the numbers, we're just using this fact. You can just prove that the primes is at least 7 less than 23.
Okay.
Then what you do is you look where they're going to sit. Well,
right.
Let's just say one of them might be even, one of them might be 2, but all the others are going to be odd.
Okay.
So we've got 6 odd primes going between 3 and 23.
Yeah.
Therefore, by the pigeonhole principle, you're going to have to get 2 which differ by 2. So therefore, there exists a prime P, it's just that P plus 2 is also a prime. By the prime number theorem.
So this is your ridiculously convoluted proof of the fact that there exists a at least one pair of twin primes.
Yes, such as 5 and 7.
Such as 5 and 7. Hey.
But this proves it without analysing the numbers.
That's pretty good.
There's another one that you showed me. Should I mention it?
Yes.
Even though you showed me.
Well, because you showed me that a while ago, and
yeah,
you told me anyway.
Yeah, but that was assuming the Riemann hypothesis. I managed to drop that hypothesis. So you don't need to assume the Riemann hypothesis to prove there's a twin prime anymore.
Okay, carry
the
on.
The reason I was worried about that is, what if somebody proved the Riemann hypothesis?
You know how like constructive mathematicians reject non-constructive proofs?
Yeah.
Are there people who reject constructive proofs?
Just like me.
How far could you get? Oh, I don't even know what that would mean. Oh, that's difficult. Maybe I should do a joint degree in philosophy and computer science.
Maybe.
Yeah, anyway, carry on.
Anyway, what I was worried about is, what if somebody proved the Riemann hypothesis assuming the existence of twin primes? Then my proof wouldn't work. So I needed to drop the Riemann hypothesis.
Okay.
Well,
no, because you could prove it without that.
Maybe.
Possibly.
But then I'd have to assume there's a proof of the Riemann hypothesis that does not depend on... Anyway, 2 to the 3rd.
2 to the power of a 3rd, okay.
Well, is it irrational or not?
I don't... Oh, this is the thing that Julia Collins talked about at Maths Jam.
What's on my whiteboard then? Blackboard.
Blackboard, yes, her from Edinburgh.
Yes. So let's assume it is rational.
Yeah.
Social contradiction. So it's equal to A over B.
Yeah.
Where A and B are natural numbers. Therefore, 2 is equal to A cubed over B cubed. Then we multiply both sides by B cubed to get 2B cubed is equal to A cubed. Or A cubed is equal to B cubed plus B cubed.
Wow.
And then by applying Fermat's theorem, no solution exists. Therefore, the cube root of 2 is irrational.
Okay.
And this also works to prove any nth roots greater than or equal to 3.
Cool.
So
that's a pretty cool fact, and we laughed a lot when we learned it. But
and also, so what comes next is 2 to the half. How do you show that that's irrational?
apart from the normal proof, show
you,
me.
You assume that it's rational, and then you form a right-angled triangle.
Yeah.
So, what does this give? What's 2? Squared, the square root of 2 squared is 2, add 2 is 4 square root of 2, so we get a right angle triangle with rational sides. Therefore, the area is a congruent number. Right?
A congruent number?
Yes.
To, what does that mean?
A congruent, it's a number's congruent if it is the area of a right angle triangle with rational sides.
Okay.
So therefore, 1 is a congruent number. And Fermat proved that 1 is not a congruent number, because if 1 is congruent, then you can construct you can construct a solution to x to the 4 plus y to the 4 is equal to z to the 4. Which, of course, is the case of Fermat's last theorem for n equal to 4. So don't worry, we can still prove it.
We can still use Fermat's last theorem to prove that root 2 is
yes.
not rational. Good.
There was more stupid proofs, but not stupid, there was more brilliant proofs.
Brilliant proofs. I mean, they're less constructive than the usual ones, so they're better.
Yes.
We've just decided this new school of maths we're starting.
There's a very nice one that says that it proves that for arbitrary large n, there exists a non-planar graph on n vertices.
Okay.
And the way you do it is you take n vertices,
yeah.
generate a graph at random, so
yeah.
with probability p you place an edge between any of the two vertices,
yeah.
and then you look at its chromatic number. So Erdős worked this out, and he created what's the probability its chromatic number will be this.
Uh-huh.
And what you can show is that as n gets arbitrarily large, with probability 1, it's going to get a lot bigger chromatic number than 4. Therefore, by the 4-colour theorem, there will exist a non-planar graph.
Pretty good.
So that's like the probabilistic method, and I think we've come full circle.
Almost, yeah. Did you say that at the start or in the middle?
Somewhere.
Somewhere.
I've got a problem I want people to solve,
oh, okay,
that I can't be bothered to solve, but we probably can't explain it on podcast form.
Give it a go.
So you take a matrix,
yeah,
M by N,
uh-huh,
you look at the ifj entry,
yeah,
and what you do is you take I and J and look at their GCD.
Uh-huh.
Then you take that number and look at the sum of its divisors,
mm-hmm,
and you plug that in the matrix. You do that for all pairs ij, so you get this little symmetric matrix popping
so
out.
So the cell ij is sigma of GCD of I and j.
Yes.
Good.
You look at that matrix, take its determinant, and you'll get n factorial.
Yeah, we saw that on John Cook's blog,
mm-hmm,
a while ago.
He didn't have a proof.
There's no proof. So is that what you're asking? You want people to prove,
yeah,
that? Okay.
Like, I don't even know. It'd be lovely if you could prove it by induction. Just say, well, assume it works up to n, and then you just look at the n bit and add it on. But that's not how matrices work. I've got this lovely little book, and that doesn't help.
University Mathematical Texts, dodecahedron on the front?
Yes.
Very good.
The side has the title.
Determinants and Matrices by A.C. Aitken.
It's a book on how to work out the determinants and matrices.
It was £6. Where's it from? Oh, is it one of the ones you got from What's-His-Face?
Yes.
Okay. Just put a bottle of Coke in front of the microphone.
Or a bottle of Pepsi.
No, it was a bottle of Coke.
Oh, would that be fair? You're periodical.
Well, there's fair and there's one I'm actually drinking. By choice, I would drink Pepsi, but they don't sell it here. So.
And the Coke was £2 for £2.
Yeah, so what are you going to do? Nice book.
Okay.
The Pfaffian of Order 2. David, there's a thing called the Pfaffian, and we haven't been talking about it for an hour. We've been talking about other rubbish for an hour.
What's the Pfaffian, dude?
I don't know what a Pfaffian is.
Where?
The square root of a skew symmetric determinant of even order is a polynomial in the half n-1 elements called a Pfaffian.
Pfaffian? Sounds French.
Pfaffians have properties in some respects resembling those of determinants, but they lack a simple multiplication theorem, such as is derived from determinants. Ah!
I wish determinants were additive.
You wish determinants were additive. It's like wishing square roots were additive.
Some first years think they are.
Yeah. David, how do you prove that something is bigger than 2?
Well, what you do is you prove it's less than 6. And because 6 is bigger than 2, it's clearly true. Should we explain why I think that?
Yeah, please.
About 90% of undergraduate math students tried to prove something was bigger than 2 by proving it was less than 6. That's all I can say about that.
That's
I should have brought along the 15 stupid proofs of why the primes are infinite.
Oh, that was good. We might talk about that later
next
on.
Time.
Yeah.
I can't think of much else. I brought another book down just because
I've
like
probably
it.
Done enough. I mean, like, I need to go home and have some dinner
so
or something.
Like.
What's that in there? Is that a little plaque? Presented to GD.
George.
Is that your first name?
No. This isn't to me. This is old.
Was it to your dad or?
Uncle? Granddad's brother.
Granddad's brother. Advanced level pure mathematics. So your granddad's brother, was that like a great uncle? I don't know what the relationship. Yeah, great uncle.
Failed to get into Oxford.
Failed to get into Oxford. Oh,
he was given this book to prepare for the exam.
What a loser! Which one of us failed to get into Cambridge, David?
I didn't apply.
I did.
Work that out, people. Did you say what? What? This was like what in the. A guy from the 40s on a council estate.
Yeah, that's
pretty. At least he sat the exam.
Yeah.
He was probably the first person in the village to sit.
Still the only man.
But he was probably the, he might have been the first person in the village who went down south.
So that's nice. That's a good book.
I was going to look through it, but it's.
Yeah, we don't have time.
When my granddad gave it to me, I think I was in like second year. Undergrad at this point,
mm-hmm.
And he told me how hard it was and how I'll see how hard maths was back then, I wouldn't be able to do it. But
was it hard?
No, it has integration in it.
Well, A level has integration in it now, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
People like to pretend A level is harder than it is now. I'm not really sure.
No. Okay, and on that sunny note, yeah, I think we'll finish there.
I wanted to mention physics. Last time.
Have you been counting elephants?
Well, yes, last time was about black holes and elephants.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, we mentioned that's general relativity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't we mention quantum mechanics?
Because we have no way of reconciling the two.
Aha, we do now.
Do we?
So how do I get an elephant into your black hole without you noticing? What I do is I come along, instead of bringing the black hole with me, I bring an elephant in a box.
Okay.
I put the elephant in the box,
yes.
Close it, then there's a non-zero probability that the elephant is inside your black hole. By quantum mechanics. So you can't say for definite that my elephant is not inside your black hole.
Okay.
I think... And after the last podcast, I also figured out a way to calculate how to count the number of elephants in a black hole.
How?
You put a mouse in and count all the elephants as they run out.
Yep. Bye, everybody.
Bye.